It's a real privilege to be here today, and it's a privilege to moderate a debate between two such influential public figures as Professor Yu and Congressman Barr. As it happens, my job is very easy today, which I always like, and that's because the subject is so important and the issue so controversial and the speaker so knowledgeable that, frankly, all I intend to do is introduce these gentlemen and then get out of their way. So let me begin with Professor Yu. Professor Yu is on the law faculty at Berkeley. He earned his bachelor's degree, summa cum laude, at Harvard and a JD at Yale Law School, where he was an articles editor of the Yale Law Journal. He clerked for Judge Lawrence Silberman of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and later for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Professor Yu served as general counsel of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee from 1995 to 1996. From 2001 to 2003, he served as a deputy assistant attorney general in the Office of Legal Counsel at the U.S. Department of Justice. Now, that is the think tank at the Department of Justice and provides legal advice to the department and other executive branch agencies. And it's really the seat, in many ways, of policymaking at the department. He worked there on issues involving foreign affairs, national security, and the separation of powers. And as you might have deduced from his fan club greeting all of us downstairs, he earned a certain measure of fame while in that position. Professor Yu has been a visiting professor at the University of Chicago and the Free University at Amsterdam, and he held the Fulbright Distinguished Chair in Law at the University of Trento in Italy. He has received research fellowships from the University of California at Berkeley, the Olin Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation, and he's a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also received the Paul M. Bator Award from this society, and he has testified before the Judiciary Committees of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives and has advised the state of California on constitutional issues. Of particular relevance here today, Professor Yu has published. He's published articles about foreign affairs and international law and constitutional law in the leading law journals, and he is the author of Powers of War and Peace, The Constitution and Foreign Affairs After 9/11, War by Other Means, An Insider's Account of the War on Terror, and most recently, and as evidenced by the table in the corner, Crisis and Command, A History of Executive Power from George Washington to George Bush. Copies of that book are available here today, and I do believe he will be signing copies for anyone who wishes to purchase one today. We are honored to have the professor with us today. Next to him, as seated at the table, is the Honorable Bob Barr. Congressman Barr has a long and distinguished career of public service. He is well known, of course, for representing the 7th District of Georgia in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1995 to 2003. He was also the 2008 Libertarian Party nominee for President of the United States. Earlier in his career, Congressman Barr was appointed by President Reagan to serve as the United States Attorney for the Northern District of Georgia, and he has served as President of the Southeastern Legal Foundation. Congressman Barr was also an official with the CIA from 1971 to 1978. Congressman Barr has held the 21st Century Liberties Chair for Freedom and Privacy at the American Conservative Union. He's a board member of the NRA. He's a member of the Constitution Project's Initiative on Liberty and Security. He was a member of a project at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government devoted to matters of privacy and security. And perhaps most noteworthy, recognizing his leadership in privacy matters, the late and great New York Times columnist William Safire once dubbed him Mr. Privacy. Congressman Barr currently serves on the board of Privacy International, an international privacy watchdog group headquartered in London. The congressman is also a member of the board of advisors for the Georgetown Journal of Law and Public Policy, the Texas Review of Law and Politics, and he serves now as an adjunct professor at the John Marshall Law School in Atlanta. He has spoken to audiences across America and internationally. He has served as an official member of the U.S. delegation at several major U.N. conferences. He now practices law with the law offices of Edwin Marger, and he runs a consulting firm, Liberty Strategies, in Atlanta. Congressman Barr earned his J.D. at Georgetown, a master's from the George Washington University, and a bachelor's degree from the University of Southern California. And we are very privileged to have Congressman Barr here with us today. So, without further ado, I do want to bring up our first speaker. Let me just tell you that the format for today's event is a simple one, and it's roughly three parts. Professor Yu will speak first for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then he will be followed by the congressman. And then we will open the floor to questions for the remaining 20 minutes or so. So let's begin, and I'm pleased to introduce to all of you Professor John Yu.
Well, I'd like to thank you for the very kind. Well, thanks for paying the fee to the Federal Society. All right, see you.
Wow. Did I mention the word controversial during my introduction?
I'm just glad that she's added to the Federal Society's coffers for lunch today. So I'd like to thank you for that kind introduction, and I'd like to thank Chris, who's not with us for the moment, for making me feel at home by arranging for people here in the audience and outside to follow me here from Berkeley. Although I think they're not going to last much longer in the 20-degree cold, which we don't experience much out where I'm from. I'm also very glad to debate my friend Congressman Barr, who was the 2008 Libertarian presidential candidate, which we've never talked about, but I always thought it must be hard to raise money from people as the Libertarian candidate for a presidential election because Libertarians don't like to part with their money. And so I've always wondered, how does one actually do that? But before I get to the substance, I'd like to talk about what's on everybody's mind, which is, how did I beat Jon Stewart on The Daily Show? Which is a question I get all over wherever I go now. So for those of you who didn't see it, I was on The Jon Stewart Show a few weeks ago, and then apparently so frustrated him that the next day he went on the air, and according to my students, for the first time ever, said that I'd beaten him. And so in thinking this over, I thought, well, he probably doesn't have many law professors as guests, because if you think about it, we spend all of our time corralling young college-age students who think they're very smart but have done no reading. I used these tools on Mr. Stewart, just a few minutes of the Socratic method, and he was mine. So that's how it happened. So let me talk very quickly about the book, which is definitely for sale, and I'd be very happy to sign any copies, as many copies as you'd like to buy. The basic idea of the book actually started with a study sponsored between the Federal Society and the Wall Street Journal. Back in 2005, the two organizations did a poll of 300 political scientists, historians, and law professors about who they thought the greatest presidents in American history were, and actually asked us to rank all of them in order. I was one of the people they surveyed. And so when I saw this list, I thought it would be interesting to write a book about how these presidents thought of the Constitution and whether that had anything to do with their success or failure. Now, you might be surprised or not to learn that the list of scholars' favorite presidents is quite at odds with sort of regular Americans' views of who our best presidents have been. So I think about 3-4 weeks ago, there was a survey done by an august publication, I think it was Parade Magazine, about which president should be added to Mount Rushmore. So who might you think the number one president most people thought ought to be added to Mount Rushmore might be? No, not Reagan. It would be Kennedy. John F. Kennedy was the number one president who most Americans. Reagan, I think, was third. Barack Obama, by the way, I think was fourth. And I think FDR was second. When you poll presidents, however, and I think the reason why Kennedy is on there is because he's sort of the first president most people today remember seeing on TV and so on. He was the first TV president, many people say. But if you look at the list of great presidents that scholars come up with, it goes Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt are considered the greatest presidents. And then actually some after this might surprise you. Thomas Jefferson was fourth, Teddy Roosevelt was fifth, and then Reagan, who many said was is actually sixth now, which is pretty remarkable. When Reagan left office, he was rated by many scholars to be a below average president. It's only with the passage of time that his reputation has gone up. Harry Truman is seventh, another president who left office with approval ratings in the low 30s. His reputation has also gone up as time has passed. Number eight, this might be a surprise to some of the older members of the audience, is Dwight Eisenhower, who when he was president was thought of as being an out of touch, somewhat grandfatherly figure in the office. The ninth president, greatest president, is James Polk, who many Americans probably have never heard of, right? Probably our most successful one-term president. And then the 10th is Andrew Jackson. The other thing that's also interesting is who some of the worst presidents have been, which we don't often write about. The worst president is Buchanan. And when I talk at college audiences, I have to make clear this is not Pat Buchanan, who some of them might have missed as when he was in his presidency, but James Buchanan, who was the president right before Lincoln, and many of the other presidents at the bottom are people who were either in the period before or right after the Civil War. And then also down in there, aside from that, is Richard Nixon. I'll make a case today about why James Madison, who actually is usually on the banner of the Federalist Society, his profile's on the banner, deserves to be down in the bottom too. So what is it about these great presidents and bad presidents and their relationship to the Constitution that helped make them great or not? And I think that the thesis is pretty simple, at least in my view. It's that many of our greatest presidents were presidents who were confronted by crisis, emergency, even war, and they responded to it by interpreting the powers of their office broadly, oftentimes in conflict with the views of the other branches, and that our weakest presidents are ones who, confronted with many of the same crises, actually retracted into a shell and often deferred to the other branches for solutions rather than taking up the mantle themselves. Some examples of this include George Washington, who, if you remember, the father of the country, brought us through the Revolutionary War, was the first president, I think is the only president still has ever been elected unanimously in the Electoral College. His great crisis was not just the founding of the great opportunities, not just to found the country, but the great crisis was the Neutrality Proclamation affair, the Revolutionary War in France. And in response to suggestions that the United States would have to enter the war on France's side because of our peace treaties with France stemming from the Revolutionary War, Washington decided that it would be the executive branch that would declare neutrality and set foreign policy for the country, for which he was terribly attacked by Thomas Jefferson, his Secretary of State, and James Madison, one of the supporters, one of his previous supporters in Congress, so much so to the point that the Neutrality Proclamation prompted the foundation of the Democratic Party, which the framers had never anticipated or wanted. The response to Washington was so negative and great that partisan politics entered our political culture for the first time. Another example would be Abraham Lincoln. Actually the contrast between Buchanan and Lincoln is really the heart of the book. Many people don't realize that Buchanan, when he confronted the crisis of secession, actually thought that secession was unconstitutional. However, he thought that the president had no constitutional powers to prevent a state from leaving the Union. And he actually wrote out a legal opinion himself and issued it in the period between Lincoln's election and his inauguration, saying the president just doesn't have any power to stop secession from occurring. Lincoln, of course, comes into office. He's confronted with the same or even worse circumstances. He interprets his constitutional powers as not just that secession is legal, but preventing it from happening. And you all here were in the Union League, right? You probably can recall many of the steps he took at the beginning of the Civil War to preserve the Union, including raising an army and navy, taking money out of the treasury, starting offensive military operations against the South, ultimately suspending the writ of habeas corpus to the point where he refused to obey a writ from the Chief Justice of the United States. And ultimately, I think his greatest act, the Emancipation Proclamation, If you think about it, the Emancipation Proclamation was what we would call today a unilateral act of presidential power. The law at the time was very much against what Lincoln did. If you remember, we're all lawyers here. What do you remember was the governing precedent about slavery in 1862 at the time of the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation's first draft. It was Dred Scott, right? The author of the majority opinion, Dred Scott, it was still the Chief Justice of the United States at this time. Dred Scott said it was unconstitutional for the federal or state governments to try to prevent slave owners from taking their slaves anywhere they wanted to within the United States because slaves were property, right? Congress at the time also had actually passed a law about how to emancipate the slaves. And any of you here who've had the pleasure of working in the Congress, as I have, no offense, Congressman, can guess what Congress's solution was. It was to create individualized federal court hearings to prove that each slave that was about to be freed actually had an owner that was in the Confederacy. And I don't know what federal court dockets here in Illinois are like, but we'd still be hearing these cases today if this was the governing law on slavery. Washington, right under his powers as commander-in-chief, says the freeing of the slaves are a war measure. That's why the Emancipation Proclamation oddly only applied in the South and did not free any of the slaves in the loyal parts of the Union that had slavery. So slavery, even after the Emancipation Proclamation, continued to exist in places like Kentucky, Maryland. But nonetheless, it's an example of the president interpreting their powers broadly, quite in times of conflict with the other branches for the public interest. The last person I'll talk about real quickly in terms of great presidents is FDR. And right now we're having a great debate about the New Deal and its legitimacy as the government considers nationalizing healthcare. But I think everyone can agree that FDR's claim to greatness at least lies in his vision, seeing that Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan would be the threats they were, and taking steps to make sure the country could get into World War II perhaps earlier than, for example, Congress wanted. In the 1930s, Congress passed a series of neutrality acts designed to prevent the United States from helping the Allies or getting into World War II. And now that the archives are open, we realize Roosevelt took a number of steps to get the U.S. into the war early, including ultimately ordering the United States Navy to fire upon German submarines in the Atlantic Ocean, which FDR, as we now know, secretly told Churchill was done in the hopes of creating a military incident, which might allow him to bring the U.S. into the war earlier than it otherwise would. And I think for bringing the U.S. into the war earlier than, say, late 1942 or 1943, both the United States and the world were much better off. In terms of bad presidents, I've already mentioned Buchanan. I'd like to just mention briefly James Madison, who I think was a great, obviously great drafter of the Constitution, but a terrible president. Madison, if you remember, was a short fellow. He was about 5'2", and he had a squeaky high voice. He didn't like meeting new people. He didn't like giving speeches. He loved to work in committees behind the scenes. He is, as you can imagine, a favorite of professors everywhere. His qualities. Madison really thought that it was Congress that should take the lead in setting national security for foreign policy, which was the view he'd taken in attacking George Washington. He did not try to stop Congress from driving the country into the War of 1812. In fact, the phrase war hawks that we use today actually comes from the description of congressmen in the freshman congressmen in particular who drove the country into the War of 1812. A stronger president who had a broader view of his powers would have refused to wage the war or tried to block Congress from trying to declare it. Madison deferred to Congress in taking the country into, I think, despite all the wars we've had and the problems that they might have encountered, is probably the worst strategic war we've ever fought. If you recall, in the Napoleonic Wars at this time, the two superpowers in the world are fighting to the death, and the United States is making enormous amounts of money trading to both sides, as we like to do during wars in Europe. And we declared war on the only side that had a large navy and a long land border with the United States, with military forces positioned along the border. We did it all with the hopes of invading and taking over Canada. That was the great plan. The American history, periodically you see people in the United States wanting to take over Canada for unknown reasons. But I always think if we succeeded, we'd already have universal health care by now, at least. The British, right, blockade our coastline. They actually capture and occupy and burn to the ground our capital, and would have come close with the invasion at New Orleans if it succeeded in splitting the country in two. That was their ultimate plan, was to drive a force up the Mississippi, cut the country in half, and prevent the United States from expanding to the west. So what are the lessons? Let me just close here. What are the lessons for executive power? Maybe make a few comments about the Obama administration and terrorism policy. You know, one thing is that the reason we have an executive branch is to exactly for the purpose of meeting unforeseen circumstances, emergencies, and war. If Congress could predict everything that would happen in the future and could prepare for it, you wouldn't really need an executive branch. The reason it's structured the way it is, with responsibility and accountability in one person at the top, is, so as the Federalist paper said, so that the branch could move swiftly, decisively, and with secrecy when the circumstances required. At the same time, even in wartime, there are plenty of checks and balances. We live in this today where there's this myth that presidential power is essentially unchecked. But if you look at all these periods in American history in the past, Congress has always had the power of the purse, the power to pass legislation. The Supreme Court has its own powers, often after the fact, but all which can be used to check presidential initiative. Look at how the Vietnam War ended. The Vietnam War ends with a funding cutoff. Many people don't know the Mexican-American War of 1848 also was ended by a funding cutoff. President Polk, after that war, we had occupied Mexico City. President Polk actually had in mind occupying and annexing all of Mexico, not just the good parts. Congress actually cut that off. So instead of California, Nevada, and New Mexico and Arizona, the Southern American border might have gone all the way down to Central America if Polk had had his way. People in Congress wanted no part of it and cut off funds for all military operations after the fall of Mexico City. So Congress has those powers. It's just a question of whether they want to have the political will to use them. So when we see periods today when the executive branch does take the initiative in foreign policy or national security, it's not because the Constitution has failed in some way. It's because Congress has just simply chosen as a matter of policy not to contest executive branch initiatives. So where does that leave us today with President Obama? And at the table over lunch, we were talking about President Obama's national security policies. In one sense, you can sort of understand them as the executive branch returning to or attempting to return to some amount of deference to the other branches. In particular, we think about what I think is a terrible decision to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, one of the 9/11 hijackers, in New York City in civilian court, or the recent decision to automatically send the Detroit Christmas Day bomber into the civilian law enforcement system. If you think about it, when you take both of those steps, the executive branch is essentially giving to the judiciary the final say about the disposition of terrorists, whether you're even going to hold them or not, is going to be a decision for the courts rather than a final decision of the executive branch, which it has historically been in wartime. So it's, unique deference, shifting over the decision to another branch. At the same time, I think you see aspects of the president still relying on the same grants of executive power than the previous administration did in the decision to surge troops in Afghanistan, redoubled use of the Predator drones, again, all on executive power. So I think, and I'll close here, it would be ironic to me, but I think it would be wholly in keeping with the practices of previous presidents if Obama's success or failure and how he's ultimately going to rank on that list of great to worst presidents ultimately arrives not because of efforts to nationalize health care or control greenhouse gas emissions, but will ultimately come on how he does in national security policy in Iraq, Afghanistan, and in the war on terrorism. So with that, thank you very much, and I look forward to Congressman Barr's comments and questions from you. Thank you.
If there are no protesters, I think we're ready to hear from Congressman Barr.
It is a tremendous pleasure to certainly once again share a program with fellow constitutionalists, fellow Federalists, and certainly to share a program that I have enjoyed participating in for a number of years, and that is with John Yoo. I would much rather be debating some of the folks that I debated on the Judiciary Committee when I was in the Congress. They were much less pleasant, much less learned than John Yoo is. The guy makes it very difficult. One, he knows what he's talking about, very different from a lot of my former colleagues. He's very pleasant about it, different from a lot of my former colleagues. And I actually learn a great deal as many times as I've had the honor and pleasure of participating in debates with John. Every time I come away with him learning something new, a little bit different, and this one is no different. I've already made a few notes here. I also enjoy very much always an invitation to come to Chicago. You know, from time to time, politics in Georgia gets kind of boring, so it's always nice to come to Chicago. I don't think y'all have ever had a boring campaign season here in Chicago, we sort of knew when John and I came in the building, we got a cab over from the hotel together, and then there were some of his friends downstairs that we saw, and you know, I thought, well, we can just invite them up, but I think probably better that his view prevailed, and that we did not invite them up. But it is the topic, as Gil said, that we're talking about here today, and that is the power of the presidency, the power of the Constitution, the power of law in this country could not be more important. And in that respect, let me start from mentioning something that I don't do too often, both because time rarely permits it and Hollywood doesn't produce that many good movies these days, but recently went to a movie with my wife and a couple of our kids, a movie called The Book of Eli. I don't know whether any of you all have seen it. There's a couple of very, very interesting twists to the movie, which I will not disclose today, unless pressed during the Q&A period, of course. But the Book of Eli is a very enjoyable movie and a very interesting movie. It's both entertaining, but it makes you think. And the thing that really I think is relevant for our discussion here today in talking about the Constitution, at least that's what I think we ought to be talking about when we are talking about the powers, the appropriate powers of the presidency, is the Constitution, as any discussion of this great land of ours ought to begin and end with the very same document, and that is the Constitution of these United States. But in this movie, while the Constitution did not figure into the movie did center around the notion of the power of ideas, the power of the written word. The book that figured in the movie was the Bible, but There was very little discussion of what was actually in it, but the movie centered around the notion of the power of that document, the power of the written word, and the power of the values that are reflected in it. And I think we need to keep in mind that it is the Constitution, what I consider the greatest document writ by the hand of man. The value of that Constitution, and similar to the Bible in the Book of Eli, the power of what is contained in it and the importance of adhering to it and the importance of recognizing that words in that document actually mean something and need to be looked at in the context of their positioning in there, the words that are used, and this notion that we have with modern presidencies, that they can reach into that document and pull out, sort of take a pair of scissors and cut out a phrase that they like that supports what they want to do, or that provides a justification for what they want to do to expand their power beyond that which was intended to accrue to them in that document, I think is something very dangerous. And rather than holding up and idealizing presidents who did that and who do that, we ought to be looking at them as constitutionalists, as federalists, in a much more, a much different light. A presidency to me is defined not necessarily by how strong that president is. You know, we're not in some banana republic. But if you listen to what John is saying, you might almost buy into that. Man, we need somebody up there who's macho, who gets up here and says, my people. There was a movie called Moon Over Parador a number of years ago, and Richard Dreyfuss got up there and he sort of got carried away with it. You know, my people, my brothers, my sisters, my uncles, and so forth. But that notion that the value of a chief executive is reflected purely or ultimately in how powerful they are, how macho they are, because after all, the job of a president is to protect the nation. The first and foremost, the job of the president is to protect the nation, and whatever it takes. We need that president to fulfill that primary ultimate responsibility. And if it takes taking liberties with the law, that's okay, because he's being a strong president. He's protecting the nation. If it means from time to time simply ignoring or violating a law, such as Abraham Lincoln did, such as more recently George W. Bush did, well, that's okay, because they're doing it for the right reason. To me, a presidency is not defined by that. The presidency is defined by whether or not the person occupying that office is fulfilling their primary responsibility, and that is to protect freedom, to protect liberty, to protect that document and what it represents. And if a president believes that he or she needs certain powers beyond those which Congress has already granted to it through laws, or which courts have allowed through interpreting those laws or interpreting positions that president has taken, well, to me, the great president isn't one that just sort of sweeps that aside and says, because the Constitution here says I am the commander-in-chief and I can wear that hat whenever and however I like and to what and exercise those powers to whatever extent I want, and I define what that means, we have a situation I don't think is consistent with what our country is about. And certainly is not consistent with the words read in the context of the document. Yes, one could, what they meant. Yes, one could look at that in Article 2 and say, yes, the president does serve as the commander-in-chief. And Alexander Hamilton tells us in Federalist 74 that the president does serve as the commander-in-chief. And that's important because, and John is correct in this, because during time of war, during those times when use of the national military is important and must be exercised, administratively it would make no sense whatsoever to have 435 or however many members of Congress there were back in that first Congress, or however many senators there were. I mean, that would make no sense whatsoever. So certainly, having just extricated themselves from a war much more serious than that, than war with a small W that we face today. I mean, they faced one with a capital W. Coming off of that, yes, they understood the need, as George Washington, certainly as our first president and our nation's first commander-in-chief, even before he became president, understood it is important whenever the nation employs its military, its army or its navy, and now it's Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard, in battle, it is important to have one administrative voice, one executive, and that is the president. But there is nothing in that document that is known as the Constitution. There is nothing writ in those great documents called the Federalist Papers that says simply because the president serves as commander-in-chief, that that is an affirmative grant of power to the president to go beyond giving orders in the military that must then be carried out, so that the president can define whether or not the Constitution or the Bill of Rights even applies to him. I truly don't think that James Madison, who I hold in probably somewhat higher esteem than John does, or Alexander Hamilton, who wrote a number of the Federalist Papers as well, those primarily dealing with executive power, the power of the president, or even John Jay to a much lesser extent because of the problems that he had and that rendered his ability to write a lot of the papers taken away. I don't think any of them would adhere to this notion that simply because the president serves as the commander-in-chief means that he can decide when the Bill of Rights applies to him or when the writ of habeas corpus can be suspended, notwithstanding the fact that the president has no authority whatsoever to suspend the writ of habeas corpus in the Constitution, and it is dealt with specifically in the Constitution, as we know. Or whether the president has the power simply because he dons that magnificent hat with all the scrambled eggs on it on a particular day, that he is the commander-in-chief, that he can say, I'm going to order that phone conversations and email transmissions of American citizens are going to be intercepted and listened to without court order, even though the Fourth Amendment has been held to apply to such communications, and even though there happens to be a law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, dating back to 1978, signed into law by a president that probably both John and I would agree would not rank real high on the list, that requires a warrant to be had. But in any of those instances, in any of those presidencies, if in fact a president believes that the powers defined or granted to him by law or by court decisions are inadequate to provide the tools that he believes he needs in order to fulfill that important responsibility, and it is an important responsibility of the president to serve as the commander-in-chief and to protect the nation's security, I'm not downplaying that, then there are remedies that that president has. Go to the Congress. This may not always be easy, but go to the Congress, and in the last several years, had President Bush gone to the Congress early in his administration, in the days following, the months following the attacks of 9/11, or in 2002 or 2003, during the time after 2003 when the war in Iraq was in Afghanistan were being prosecuted, had the president gone to the Congress and laid out a case that the powers granted or the limitations imposed by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and as interpreted by the courts, and the courts don't always get it right, and there were some decisions with regard to the applicability of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that needed to be addressed that were wrong. Had the president done that, Congress would have probably tripped over itself, giving him the power, expanding the power of FISA, the powers in FISA, and in any number of other areas. But no, it is easier, I grant John this, it is easier for a president not to worry about doing that. Yeah, it takes some time, and President Lincoln didn't want to wait, so he just did all sorts of things that the law did not provide and the Congress did not provide. To me, that doesn't necessarily make him a great president because he ignored the law and ignored Congress. But there are ways to do these things. But simply sweeping all of those things off the table and saying a president, because in their mind it's necessary to do these things, notwithstanding a law that provides otherwise or court decision that limits their ability to do things, that they can just ignore that. I mean, that document, the Constitution, including the Bill of Rights, and the great body of national security law and Fourth Amendment law that we have, actually means something. I know that John has written extensively on these things, and he is very learned about it, and it's important for us to have a debate on these things. But to just sweep aside, for example, the Fourth Amendment and its requirement for warrants simply because a president decides, I'm going to conduct a search or order a search, not for law enforcement purposes, but for national security purposes, therefore, the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply, flies in the face of history. The Fourth Amendment was not predicated on the simplistic notion that we don't want police breaking into people's houses and conducting searches without an appropriate judicially sanctioned reason. That was in part of it. But remember where our nation was coming from at that time. Whether one is looking at the Second Amendment and the right to keep and bear arms, an area that John and I have probably uniform agreement on the importance of that as an individual right. You all are going to have a case here and argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in about 3 weeks, the McDonald case, City of Chicago, that hopefully will move us a little bit further down that, what Madison defined as the constitutional road on that issue. But the Fourth Amendment as well, just like the Second and like the others, they were in direct reaction in many respects to what the British had done. The Fourth Amendment was placed in the Constitution not simply for the purpose of keeping the local constable at bay. It was placed there because the colonists had year after year after year of experience of the power of government coming into their houses with writs of assistance or with nothing more than simply a musket and a bayonet. So to say, here we are in the year 2001, shortly after the attacks of 9/11, and conjure up some notion that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply if the president orders a search without warrant or without probable cause or without reasonable suspicion of a U.S. citizen's home or their electronic communications, because the Fourth Amendment was not meant to apply to the government, power of the federal government coming in, I don't think is quite accurate. These things do matter. The history of the Fourth Amendment, the history of the as we see in the Federalist Papers, the very deep and abiding suspicion that our founders had with regard to a presidency, a chief executive, that could simply do whatever they wanted. They'd been there, they'd done that. They'd seen what it did to freedom and liberty when the British did that. They didn't want that, and they crafted a system of government laid out in those great documents, the Constitution, Bill of Rights, the Federalist Papers, that actually means something. So I look forward to a debate, not just here today. I mean, this is a debate that all of us ought to be having with our friends, colleagues, fellow members of the bar, and certainly government officials and candidates on a regular basis, because the stakes are extremely high. And what makes it particularly enjoyable in dealing with these issues with John is he understands the value of that, as the Federalist Society certainly does. At the end of the day, we may come down on different sides or different permutations of the answers to these great questions. But it is after a very thorough debate on the issues, on the merits, on the history. So at the end of the day, however we come out, at least we will have gone through a legitimate and I find very enjoyable process with the Federalist Society and with John in particular to arrive at the answers to these fundamental questions. Gil, look forward to the Q&A. Thank you all.
You know, before we open the floor to questions, I do want to invite Professor Yu in just a minute or two. Even better. All right, very good. Well, then we'll take... We'll take questions. Yes.
I question the assertion, Bob, that Congress, and I'm going to paraphrase, I'm not going to say as well as you did, that Congress would be more than happy to consider and grant the president the right to do some of the things that the presidents in recent years have not felt they could do. What is your basis for that? There's such gridlock.
The USA Patriot Act was passed very rapidly in the few weeks right after 9/11. The USA Patriot Act, which at the time I voted for, much to my later chagrin after seeing how it was used, that act included within its several hundred pages, I forget how many, tremendous expansion of federal government powers and the powers of a number of different agencies, and that happened very, very quickly. The administration, when they sent it up to the Congress, it looked as if initially it would not even have hearings. They said, "Oh, we don't bother with hearings. It's a national emergency. We need to get this thing through." Thank goodness Henry Hyde, on the House side, said, "No, wait a minute. We need at least to have some hearings," and had General Ashcroft come up and some other witnesses and so forth. So at least we had some debate about these issues. But that happened very quickly. And I have to tell you also that with regard to the subsequent proposed amendments to FISA, which wound up passing the Congress in the summer of 2008, even with the support of then-Senator, now President Obama, had those been proposed at any time before that, I can tell you also they would have been approved very, very rapidly. So I think there are a number of instances, particularly after 9/11, where Congress has indicated a very, very clear predisposition, if you know the perceived need is there, to grant those powers very quickly. Now, that's not always the case, I grant you that, certainly, but in the environment in since 2011, it has been.
Please, also...
9/11.
What did I say?
2011.
Oh, yes. I don't know. I don't know anything about next year.
I just want to add something to your point, which is, you know, when, obviously it's in the national interest that President and Congress agree on national security strategy, and I don't think the Bush administration often gets enough credit for the Patriot Act authorizations of force in Afghanistan and Iraq and a lot of the other places where the administration did go to Congress. But there's and this war is a little different than other ones. It makes it more difficult, which is, we're not really fighting an enemy that has territory, population, or cities. And so a lot of the traditional means that we would use to conduct war against, say, in Iraq or Nazi Germany, don't really work here, because we're not going to win by outproducing and, you know, outfielding the enemy. Instead, it's really a covert war of intelligence. And so because of that, and the second point is, we're not fighting a bunch of fools. I mean, these are very highly educated people in Al-Qaeda. I mean, the number two member of Al-Qaeda has a medical degree. You know, Muhammad Atta had a master's degree in architecture. I mean, these are people who are very smart, and they monitor our government. So I think one of the fundamental problems in this war, unlike others, is that if the executive branch did go to Congress, as Congressman Barr asked, and said, "Will you give us the ability to conduct warrantless surveillance for emails and phone calls of this nature coming into the country from terrorists overseas," that would tip off our technological advantage to be able to do that. Just a small example of this was during the trial of the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993. One of the things the government wanted to do, at least in turn publicly, was to eventually show that Osama bin Laden was involved with the decision. And so the government leaked at that time in the mid-90s trial that the National Security Agency had intercepted the personal cell phone calls of Osama bin Laden instructing people to carry out this attack. And within, I think, 48 hours, Osama bin Laden stopped using that cell phone and never has used one since. It was thought technologically impossible at the time to be able to intercept cell phone calls that were encrypted. But because of that, we lost this amazing advantage in terms of our ability to fight Al-Qaeda. And so the difficulty is not just one about the President and Congress fighting over powers, but it's also how do you get the President and Congress together when anything you talk about in public and, you know, at least in passing laws, is going to be immediately known.
Even in private.
But it'll become known to Al-Qaeda, and they'll respond immediately to it.
Yes.
Professor Yu, I'm reading your 2006 book right now, and what I see in that and what I hear today is that there's a lot of honest and excellent debate over the interplay between Congress, the presidency, and the judiciary, but there isn't, that I've seen so far, and I'm not done, talk about what the goals they're pursuing. Could these goals that we're pursuing, this interfering or helping or building governments, isn't this part of the cause of why so many people are trying to attack us, or is this completely unrelated?
Well, I'm sorry, I've been asked to repeat the question to the extent possible because we're being taped today. And I think the question is, isn't it possible that one of the reasons that we are finding ourselves under attack and vilified, our efforts to, I'm not even recapturing this fairly.
Right, and why we are having to take these measures. It's because of this expansive foreign policy of nation building, and these are putting stress on the Constitution, not our institutions.
All right. Right. So are we taking these measures that are stressful to the Constitution?
I think that's a fine question. I hate to disappoint you, but you should still read to the end of the book. But I don't talk about this. I think if it's more what you're talking about is more a matter of strategy than law. And I'm not sure. I mean, I have to say I suspect that, from what I've read of Al-Qaeda's beliefs and why they do what they do, even if we weren't nation building, they would have 10 other reasons to hate the United States and want to attack us. I saw a, people, for example, the Obama administration has said, if we close down Guantanamo Bay, that'll end a big recruiting tactic for Al-Qaeda. Guantanamo Bay is like number 10 on the long list of things they complain about. The first one, I think, being that we kicked out the caliphate out of Spain in 1492, and then it goes on and on. I mean, so I think even if we weren't nation building, it's more that the United States, supports Arab governments they don't like, but also the United States has a lot of cultural and individual freedoms. The Al-Qaeda guys would really hate Bob if they ever met him, right? They would hate the idea of libertarianism, right? They think about, all the things that the personal freedoms we have would just run counter to Al-Qaeda's vision. That said, I do think the argument make is one that Gary Wills makes in his new book, that sort of a interventionist foreign policy abroad has generally placed, and particularly exacerbated by the presence of nuclear weapons, has really placed stresses on the Constitution. And what I try to do in my book is actually say it's not a sharp departure. What we've really been doing for the last 10 years now is taking the rules that basically govern war and adapting them to this new problem, this enemy without a territory and a state. How do we rethink things like surveillance, which becomes much more important now than it used to be in previous wars, but there's no actual enemy capital to surveil. The enemy disguises itself as civilians, and which is actually the core rule of the laws of war you shouldn't do, is they disguise themselves as civilians and they invite attacks on civilians. So that's really, or I think it's a very provocative question, but way outside my job description, or as President Obama would say, my pay grade to answer.
We had a question in the back, yes.
I have to admit, I have not had an opportunity to read your book.
You can easily rectify that by the end of the lunch. Yes.
I guess my difficulty in agreeing with you on certain principles is that I guess I'd like to know your thoughts on that sort of infamous quote that Richard Nixon said.
Yeah.
The president does it, it's not illegal.
And not to give away the ending, but I do talk about that in the book, the Nixon's quote. Yeah, now you have to read it. It was actually hard to find a citation to it because it was on a TV program. And I wasn't going to sit through hours with David Frost to find it. So, or watch the movie on the airplane about the Frost-Nixon debates. So, as you know, the famous quote is by Richard Nixon. He was being interviewed by David Frost a few years after he left the presidency. And Nixon said something along the lines, if the president does it, it's not illegal. I certainly don't agree with that. And actually, the Lincoln Emancipation Proclamation example, sir, I try to use to prove my point. I mean, the president's power extends as far as, and here I don't disagree with Bob, we disagree where the line is, it extends as far as the power goes. So just because the president's commander-in-chief and we're in a war doesn't mean he could nationalize health care. Right? It's not related to the fighting of a war. The Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves only in the areas of active fighting. Lincoln actually did not think he had the constitutional power to free the slaves in the North. And he was actually so worried about it that he really pressed for the enactment of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution while he was in office, because he actually thought when the war was over, he as president would have to return all the slaves to their owners. And so I think that's how I would think of it too, is that, you know, the president, say, is commander in chief or to protect the country. He has the power, but it has to be reasonably related to what he wants to do. What Nixon's problem was that he was using his national security powers to follow his domestic political enemies who were completely unlinked to any foreign threat.
Go
ahead, Bob.
No, I don't want to interrupt that.
The second short answer is just given that's the line, presidents often, Bob made this point in his talk, will cross that line. It's no guarantee we'll always have good people as president. We certainly haven't had good people all the time as president. I guess the question is, do you think you could write a legal code out in advance to bind the president down so that never happens at the cost of losing the flexibility that allowed Washington and Lincoln and FDR to succeed? I think I'd rather rely on the political process. Congress to use its own powers in the midst of it to take care of it. Nixon, after all, is removed by the threat of impeachment. Andrew Johnson, who fought with Congress about Reconstruction, is basically run out of office under impeachment. I think the political process actually does respond when people in Congress genuinely want to use those powers.
If I could just add and follow up to what just the immediate prior point that John was making, that he doesn't mean to say, and I certainly agree with him on this, that a president making decisions as commander-in-chief could not do whatever the president wanted. There has to be some relationship to him serving as commander-in-chief. The problem, though, is the way the current environment and the last two administrations, or certainly the prior administration, have defined the war on terrorism, there's very little that it wouldn't arguably reach, because the administration defines the so-called global war on terror as truly global. That is, there is no place on the face of the earth, or certainly in our country, that is not part of the battlefield. Anybody, any person is a potential terrorist, therefore anybody is suspect, and acts of terrorism, which are akin to acts of war in this scenario, could be virtually anything. Any act against a government official, any act against a government institution or building, or so forth, any act that involves violence or the threat of violence, in an effort as part of a plan to change government policy, becomes something that then could be subject to a president's very expansive definition or concept of serving as commander-in-chief, and therefore any communication would be reachable, for example. So as opposed to earlier conflicts, in which I think the point John is making may have some currency, in the current environment, with his very expansive view of the so-called war on terror, there really is very little that a president couldn't reach in terms of having a very expansive view of serving and carrying out acts as the so-called commander-in-chief.
To respond to Congressman Barr's points about the Fourth Amendment, particularly whether it's consistent with the use of the word reasonable in the Fourth Amendment. And so I think one place where Congressman Barr and I disagree is his emphasis that the Fourth Amendment requires a warrant before every search. Because what the Fourth Amendment says, it says the government can't conduct unreasonable searches and seizures. And then it just talks about warrants right afterwards without connecting to. And during the 60s and 70s, the Supreme Court basically elided the two and made it seem as if in order to have a reasonable search, you needed to get a warrant. But in the last 20 years, the Supreme Court has moved away from that position and is now upheld a number of searches that occur without a warrant, because they're either not for law enforcement purposes or they're generally reasonable, like drunk driver checkpoints, for example, or random drug testing of government and military employees. And I think this has direct bearing on the program we're arguing the most about, which is the warrantless surveillance program. Because I think, the courts the Supreme Court has never touched on the question directly. The lower courts have actually said an effort to try to find information through surveillance of national security threats is more a product of the reasonableness part of the Fourth Amendment, does not have to necessarily be governed by the warrant requirement. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act's warrant requirement does not, I don't think, match the Fourth Amendment standard for a warrant. But also think about the, and again, Congressman is quite right that, you know, we have this, you know, what are the new pressures placed on by this war? One is, as I was talking about earlier, is that we're facing an enemy that disguises its communications within the normal civilian communication system, right? If you think about the enemy used to have secured email or secure telephone and wire communications, we were trying to break into it, but we knew where they were. Now we have to look through the billions of communications every day to try to filter out and find the very few terrorist communications, which look just like civilian, right? The Al-Qaeda is using, you know, Gmail. They probably have Facebook too. So the problem is, how do you do that in a reasonable way? A warrant's not going to allow you to do it because you don't even know necessarily the name and the identity of the person, the Al-Qaeda person who's carrying out the discussion. So you have to try instead to target, figure out a way to get through all the communications to find the ones that are carried out by anonymous terrorists, often using code language buried inside what appear to be civilian communications. Last thing I'll say about this is that this is not just a product of the 21st century. Actually, the executive branch had carried out warrantless surveillance from the time of Woodrow Wilson all the way through to the unnamed president in the 70s who signed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and convinced Congressman Barr to switch careers. Franklin Roosevelt, I do talk about this episode in the book, Franklin Roosevelt, in the year and a half before Pearl Harbor, actually ordered there to be something like the terrorist surveillance program. And at the time, actually, the law was much clearer against him. At the time, the Supreme Court and a congressional statute said you cannot intercept telephone calls without a judicial warrant. And Roosevelt essentially said, I know the Supreme Court said this, but they couldn't possibly have meant doing it for finding Nazi saboteurs. It was for law enforcement. And, you know, that basic idea is carried through all the way through for presidents since.
Well, I'm sorry to say, I think we've come to the end of our time. In fact, we're over a bit. So I do want to thank everybody, and I want to thank our speakers in particular for a fascinating discussion. I don't know if you're willing to, after the event is formally concluded, take some questions, but I know Professor Yu is certainly willing to have you buy his book and to sign it. And with that, I think we're adjourned.